You're listening to Reality Sandwich Radio, where every Thursday at noon we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, body, spirit, and our planet, community, and economy. To learn more about the Healthful Living model, go to healthfulliving.org. Reality Sandwich is hosted by Julie Matthews, Certified Nutrition Consultant, and Martin Matthews, Certified Medical Hypnotherapist. Past episodes of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com. Thanks for listening. You're listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco, and welcome to Reality Sandwich, where every Thursday at noon we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, the body, our planet, our community, economy, and spirit. All six areas of the Healthful Living model, and you can read more about that at healthfulliving.org. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist and Healthful Living advocate. And today I am just absolutely honored to be speaking with nationally known lawyer, author, and public speaker and resident of the Haight-Ashbury here in San Francisco, Harrison Shepherd. He was on the show here about a year and a half ago, speaking about his book, What's Right with Lawyers, What's Wrong with Lawyers. And today, we're speaking about his new book called Too Much for Our Own Good. And what I really want to put out there to our listeners is that Reality Sandwich speaks exclusively. I mean, our thing here is speaking about engaging the health of all things in our world and all six areas of the Healthful Living model. And we're often asked the question, well, how do we get to where we are? When we look around at our world today, there is so much unhealthiness in all aspects with regard to our physical health, with regard to how we're treating the planet. A week ago, the entire country voted with regards to how unhealthy our political system is. Al Gore's movie is telling us, you know, tremendous insights. And we look around and we go, gee, how do we get to where we are? Today, we're going to speak about subject matter that speaks and explains directly America's affliction with consumption, never-ending consumption. And the book speaks about the consumeritis epidemic. The book is called Too Much for Our Own Good, The Consumeritis Epidemic and Good Movies. And I want to begin today's show with a definition of consumeritis as provided right here at the very beginning of the book. Consumeritis: a species of excessive materialism, now a pathological condition of epidemic proportions with which many Americans are actively and passively afflicted, and which is spreading to other countries. It is characterized by personal addiction to the purchase of consumer goods and services beyond what is needed to satisfy personal needs, broadly understood, often beyond the victim's financial means, and commonly diverting victims' energies and resources from more fulfilling activities and pursuits of happiness. Before I get to Harrison, I'm going to go straight to the introduction of the book and read the opening paragraph to set some context for today's interview. What this book is about. In a Humphrey Bogart movie, Key Largo, celebrated in the song of the same name, Bogart plays a war hero named Frank McLeod, who is held captive in a hotel by a paranoid gangster named Rocco, played by Edward G. Robinson. Rocco has taken over the hotel to complete a counterfeit money deal. McLeod asks Rocco what he wants out of life, and when Rocco hesitates, McLeod, who recognizes the mobster's greed as a key to his character, answers his own question for the benefit of his fellow captors. He wants more. The villain agrees. Yeah, he says, that's it, I want more. McLeod then asks Rocco whether he will ever get enough. And Rocco says, well, I never have. No, I guess I won't. Welcome to the show, Harrison Shepherd.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be here, Martin.
So I want to ask you, we were speaking just before the show, how did we get here in this condition of humanity right now? And let's speak directly about consumeritis, defining consumeritis. What is it?
The book is concerned with the extent to which American culture has become not only predominantly, but almost exclusively, a culture of buying and selling. There was a time within my lifetime, I'm in my mid-60s, when the commercial aspects of our culture were clearly an incident of our cultural life. But beginning, as the book identifies with various economic data, in at least the 80s and some say the 70s, our culture has become so pervaded by commercial advertising and commercialism that we can honestly say we become a culture of buying and selling. By the time a person in this country is 20 years old, they will have been exposed to over 1 million commercial advertisements. There is, and the message of most commercial advertisements, and advertisers themselves say this, advertising agencies and advertising consultants, the message of most of these commercials is, buy this product or service and you will fulfill your dream and find happiness. Mm. Well, the fact is that that's a lie. Every scientific study has shown that materialism is not enough to assure your happiness or satisfy what your true pursuits and longings are. But we have become in this society so overwhelmed by this tidal wave of commercialism and materialism that most people have really become addicted to buying and selling as the cultural activity in which they most participate, and have been diverted in really tragic ways from an understanding of themselves and those paths to truer happiness for which they really long. This is what the consumeritis epidemic is about. It traces the sources of this epidemic, its consequences, and makes proposals for remedying it. The consequences are truly staggering in terms of, as you've suggested, the consequences on our health, particularly the health of children, on the environment, on our social relationships, on our international relationships, and indeed in our economic well-being.
In the book, you call consumeritis the disease of the soul.
Yes, I think we can be justified in saying that based on really pragmatic examination of the consequences of materialism. Every psychological study that has addressed the issue has demonstrated that materialists, that is people who devote an excessive amount of time to materialist pursuits, and the exact scientific definition is given in the book, are all unhappy people. There's no question about that as a matter of sociology and psychology. Mm-hmm. The only question is, why are materialists unhappy? Well, the reason that the materialists are unhappy, before I give the scientific findings, broadly speaking, is because we are more in our humanity than material. We are also spirit. We also have aspirations that relate to our relationship to other people, to our aspirations for work well done, for the joys of what nature has to offer. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that we have devoted ourselves exclusively or almost exclusively or even predominantly to material pursuits, we are neglecting our own souls and spirits. The scientific research bears that out. The inquiry is why are materialists unhappy, and what the scientific studies show out of six different hypotheses that have been advanced for these conclusions. The two most important ones are, first of all, materialist goals are not as satisfying to pursue as other goals. That story from Key Largo illustrates it. If you have materialist inclinations, you always want more. So the materialist goal, achievement of the materialist goal, is always receding, and you're never going to be satisfied. As Rocco says, no, mm-hmm. I never will. Perhaps even more important than that, though, the reason that materialists are unhappy and the reason it can be called a disease of the soul is that materialism interferes with other human goals and aspirations, particularly human relations. The studies show that according to the friends and family of people who have identified themselves or can be identified as materialists, their relationships with other people are not satisfying. No one, I don't believe nobody of any ordinary intelligence and human health is likely to be happy if they have no satisfactory human relations to friends, to family, if love is absent from their lives, if they don't have good relations and some sense of their place in a community, they're not going to be happy people. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that consumeritis is an addiction to pursuit of the material things that life has to offer to the exclusion of these non-material things, it's clearly a disease of the soul.
We've had so many examples that we've seen in our world of late of people that are phenomenally successful by what others would measure, right? Financial success. Yet when we hear in-depth personal interviews with them, we find that they're personally empty, just feeling no fulfillment in their lives when everyone else is left aghast going, but you have this and you have that. And they'll say, yes, but I don't have the relationships. I don't have the family. I don't have the comfort. And yet we all still strive for those material things.
This book doesn't at all, and it's certainly not my opinion, that we don't have material needs. The problem is not the satisfaction of our material needs. The problem is when we go beyond our needs into unnecessary wants. Mm. This phenomena that you just talked about in terms of people who seem to have everything in the material realm and yet not happy is something I commented on our last interview in talking about the legal profession. In my lectures around the country about the practice of law, more than once, a very successful lawyer has come to me, obviously very prosperous, and said that I am making more money than I ever anticipated I would make, and I am unhappier than I ever anticipated I would be. That's a result of the fact, usually, that the kind of practice that brings that kind of wealth is often a practice that is inconsistent with the person's own ethical values. Mm. And understanding that you may do things as a combative war-making lawyer you wouldn't do as a peacemaking problem-solving lawyer that trouble your conscience. When this book was formally released, Too Much for Our Own Good was formally released on September 12th, we was privileged to have Mayor Gavin Newsom speak at the book release ceremonies, which was held at the Greek Orthodox Cathedral of the Annunciation, which was fitting because it does have a moral perspective. And the mayor recalled himself that when he was very young, the thing that he longed for most was a Porsche. And his father had promised him that if he – this is when he was 13 or 14 years old – that if he would not smoke a cigarette until he was 18, he would buy him a Porsche. And indeed, the mayor said he did not smoke a cigarette, and his father kept his promise by buying him a used Porsche. And he said, of course, at first he was overjoyed, but then he said it did not take him too long to realize that that was not what would give him the deepest satisfaction in his life. And he learned, he said, and I believe him because he is a very dedicated public servant, that there were things greater than material things that would satisfy his longing for what he wanted as a human being. Mm-hmm. It's true that we may well, this goes also to the causes of consumeritis and what is it that provokes and stimulates and spreads this disease, this addiction, this pathology. Too Much for Our Own Good identifies four separate causes for consumeritis in American society. The first is something that is a result of a phenomena that the French philosopher Pascal observed in the 17th century. Pascal said, there's nothing that people fear more than having nothing to do, that if they have nothing to do and they have to think about themselves, they are going to find themselves in often in some kind of despair. Well, the first thing is that shopping gives us all something to do if we have nothing else. So I think this fear of facing ourselves, this fear of not being occupied if we don't have other things that do occupy us, is a very important factor in getting people to become addicted to the culture of buying and selling. A second thing, which is observed by economists and sociologists, most famously with Thorstein Veblen, is the idea of keeping up with the Joneses. Having material things, having acquisitions is something that gives us some distinction. It shows that we have some mastery and control and some place in our society. And as much as most people hate to admit it, in fact, most people do hate to admit it, we do have an impulse to want to keep up with the Joneses and have as good a television set or a home computer or iPod as our neighbor. The third stimulant to consumeritis is the one I think is the most insidious and the one that has had actually the most power in our society, and that is commercial advertising. The American advertising industry now spends very nearly $1,000 a year for every man, woman, and child in the United States to deliver its messages. There is no volume of message similar to the message that's being delivered to that says, buy this thing or this service and you will be happy. That is the message that we are inundated with wherever we look, on radio, on television, on billboards, on the back seats of taxi cabs, on the sides of buses, on telephone poles, in sand writing at the beach. We are constantly now surrounded in the United States by the message that our very being is a being as a consumer, not as a citizen, not as a person, not as a parent, not as a lover or a friend, but a consumer. That's who we are, and that's the message that the culture is delivering to us at least a million times by the time we're 20, if we're young. And I think that this is the most the old-fashioned phrase was brainwashing. Mm-hmm. We are conditioned, which is a more strict psychological term, to think of ourselves as consumers. That has become the identity with which most Americans tend now to identify, to the corruption of their higher nature and their own true longings. The final contributing factor, which is less a cause than the others, is more of a rationalization, I think, than a cause. And that's the idea that if we buy things, we are helping the economy, that it's a good thing to do to buy things, that if we don't buy things, when we do buy things, we are being productive citizens and helping the American economy. Well, the fact is, if you look at the statistics now, this rationalization cannot hold water very far because Americans have now gone so deeply into debt through their consumer acquisitions that we're in very serious danger of financial reverses throughout American society. There are now more bankruptcies filed every year in the United States than students graduating from college. More people are falling into dire financial straits than are completing their higher education in the United States. There are more shopping malls in the United States than churches and synagogues or high schools. The amount of consumer debt that we have, which is intruding more and more on our home equity, where home equity is being used to finance our consumer purchases, is threatening to bring real financial havoc to middle America. The fact is that American savings, which were always at a relatively high level until the 70s or 80s, has now plummeted so that as a matter of macroeconomics, American savings in the aggregate are less than zero. That means that unless we can readjust our lives toward more saving and less spending, many Americans, hundreds of thousands and millions of Americans, may be facing economic disaster in the near future.
One statistic from the book is that Americans shop at least 6 hours per week but spend only 40 minutes per week playing with their children. And I read that and I thought, boy, if that's not a sign of some affliction, something that is some way of being that is so antithetical to our innate human selves, as we were speaking earlier, that something is significantly wrong here. Because if we really stop, and this is the big thing, if we really stop and ask ourselves and investigate and look at our behavior, we'll realize that it's not something that we would choose. This is not a way of being that we would choose, to spend more time shopping and consuming endlessly than taking care of ourselves and our children and our own personal needs.
That's why it's an addiction.
Yet we do. Yet we do across the board, and yet we are continually unfulfilled regardless of the toys and the things that we get. So this is really scary because people are not behaving consistent with their innate humanity. And whether we have a discussion with an individual person who is noticing their own personal, let's just call it addiction to food, such that now they're overweight or they're unhealthy or whatever it is, or the main thing that I try to do, or that most people intervening to help them is to help them understand, okay, how did you get there? Where are you? All right. And what's your true intentions, and how do we realign without telling people, look, you're stupid for getting where you are. What we're talking about here is understanding the circumstances that have affected how we got to where we are by calculated manipulation of the masses, both by advertisers and also by the government, to affect our minds and thus affect our behavior through calculated conditioning, affecting this mass epidemic that we now face called consumeritis. So I think that listeners can begin to comprehend that this is being done to us, not so much that we necessarily feel a victim, but that we can understand what's going on. And understanding what's going on is paramount to regaining our own choice over things.
That particular statistic you cite, comparing the time that Americans on average spend shopping to the time that they spend with their children, is the one that actually I found the most upsetting of all the many statistics in the book. And in fact, I think I repeat that finding three times throughout the book, precisely because it illustrates exactly what you said, Martin. It indicates that the culture of buying and selling, consumeritis, is really suppressing some of the most natural parts of our human being by the stimulation of artificial needs and wants. We don't really need, although we may want, most of what is being purchased in the United States these days. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how is it possible for us to adjust and transform the energies and the resources that we are spending so lavishly on these things that are not, strictly speaking, really things that we need, into directions that will be more fulfilling to our human being, that will, instead of the unhappiness that materialism demonstrably brings, bring us closer to that pursuit of happiness, which was one of the first promises of the United States of America as a political institution as articulated in the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. That's why the book, to continue exactly on this theme, deals in the remedies section in the last chapter with the necessity for us to redefine what we understand success to be and to take a closer look at what we mean for ourselves individually by happiness. I think that if each of us really examines in a conscious way what are the things that bring us the greatest satisfactions in life and can move us along most to a path of true happiness, then the pursuit of true happiness, we will find that it's not this materialist addiction. But the first step, before you can achieve anything, the first step is to believe that it's possible to achieve it. And before you can solve a problem, you have to recognize what the problem is. So the first step toward cure or mitigation of consumeritis is to first of all understand that you may be afflicted by it, mm-hmm. To recognize that there is a gulf between the energy and the resources you're devoting to material pursuits and what you really want to pursue for your own happiness. The book really is aimed at readers to try to suggest to them that greater awareness, exactly as you've suggested, Martin, of what their true aspirations are and what their options are to elect out of the culture of buying and selling and to cure themselves from consumeritis is likely to greatly enrich their lives and bring them closer to true happiness and fulfillment.
At Healthful Living, we call that unplugging from the matrix.
That is a very apt metaphor. Exactly. In fact, I think that the very first suggested remedy is that people should become aware of commercial advertising by detaching themselves from it. Instead of just letting it wash over you and assume that it's not having any effect, it seems to me that if just for a day or two most of us could just take a moment when we hear an advertisement on television or radio or through our cell phones, which is now happening, if we just stop and say, wait a minute, I do not need to see myself as a consumer. I do not need to see myself solicited to buy this thing. And just be aware of the fact that you are being constantly told that your role in life is as a consumer. Just that awareness itself may do something to detach ourselves, a great deal, I think, to detach ourselves from continuing to suffer from this disease.
Let's take that a little bit further to help people to understand the depth of what's going on with this advertising, and that advertisers are no longer truly selling products. They're selling hope. They're selling dreams. They're getting into our minds and telling us how inadequate we are and how that problem could be resolved by the purchase of their product.
If you examine the literature, advertising literature giving advice to advertisers, that is precisely the advice that's been given since the 1920s. But it is – if you Google advertising consultants, you will find that among – that still to this day among the top advertising messages are satisfy your dream. Mm-hmm. Advertising is definitely calculated to make it appeal not on the basis of the merits of a product or service, but on the false idea, the fantasy that making this purchase is going to satisfy some unfulfilled dream. This car will get you the girl you want. This expensive perfume will get you the guy you want. Well, there's a place for fantasy in our lives, but the fact is that most of these allures are lies. We do not become happier by increasing our material well-being beyond what we really need for existence and survival.
And the
and I should add, studies around the world show that beyond $20,000 a person, there is almost no increase in a person's sense of subjective well-being and happiness beyond the $20,000. And I know that sounds like a low figure, but that's what the data show relatively recently, that after we have $20,000 a year per person for a family, which is enough to ensure basic subsistence, our happiness does not increase with the addition of more money.
Mm. So hopefully listeners, when they read the book and listen to this conversation again, can begin to, in their own minds, deconstruct these messages and look behind them and be curious about what the advertiser is saying about them personally. I know that when I've seen that purple pill commercial at the very end, they say that not only will I feel better, but I will be better, that I can stop in that moment and feel a bit insulted that they're insinuating or actually telling me directly that I will be a better human being in some way as a result of taking this pill.
That's certainly true. And the other point that you made, which I agree with and needs to be underscored, is that people do not like to be sermonized. They do not like to be told, even the message of this book, that our material acquisitions and our consumeritis is too much for our own good. I actually gave some thought to the fact that perhaps the book should be titled Too Much of a Good Thing. The purpose here is not so much to tell people that they're being dumb. It's much rather to say, look, we have been submerged in a culture that is depriving us of the energy, the opportunity, and the awareness to take a path that will bring us greater happiness and fulfillment. And the purpose of this book is to say, let's just be more aware and be more aware of the choices that we can make to find a truer pursuit of happiness and what is meant by a pursuit of happiness for us as individuals.
Here's a piece right out of the book. Today, Americans consume upward of a third of the world's energy and vast amounts of the Earth's other resources, despite the fact that we make up less than 5% of the world's population. We are fast consuming the Earth's remaining endowment to feed our near-insatiable individual appetites. As we head into the second half of the show, I'd like to let's just get through some of the material of the other book about the severity of the impact of consumeritis on our society, on the earth, on our political structures. I mean, it's...
And we haven't really discussed all the adverse effects of consumeritis. There's a whole chapter on the adverse environmental effects, particularly what we call car consumeritis in terms of its contribution to global warming. The book is also very concerned with the adverse effects of our materialist addictions and commercial advertising on children. We have a startling increase in childhood and teenage diabetes and obesity. A terrible increase in teenage depression and suicide and juvenile crime, which definitely has connections to our culture of buying and selling. There have been youngsters, teenagers who have been murdered because they for their tennis shoes, for the latest Adidas. There are a number of these murders, which teenage homicides, which are reported in the book. The constant brand identification that young people are invited to have, you know, are you an Apple person or a PC person, really has its effect on the mentality of young people. And for those families who can't afford to get the most fashionable new shoe or device, this can cause tremendous pain to their children at school among their peers. One chapter of the book, which talks about the adverse effects of consumeritis on the individual, the family, and the community, uses the movie Clueless, where the heroine, Cher Horowitz, is a model of addiction to consumerism. Her whole life consists of buying the most fashionable clothing, and in fact, at a dinner table conversation, her father says, "I'm concerned, Cher, that you don't have any direction." And she says, "I have direction." And her boyfriend says, "Yes, all the way to the mall." The wonderful thing about that movie is that it does show Cher becoming aware of the fact that there's more to life than being a consumer when she falls in love, and that there are other aspects that are more important in understanding her friends than whether or not they're wearing the most fashionable clothing. Another aspect of this material addiction, which is really important politically and socially, is the way it has divorced us from our sense of community and our community responsibility. In fact, Alexis de Tocqueville, writing Democracy in America, said that one of his fears about democracy was that because of the individualism that it promoted and the materialism, he foresaw a day when people would really lose their community and country because of the petty and paltry pleasures with which they glut their lives until they are reduced to a nation of timid and industrious sheep of which the government is the shepherd. That was his prediction in 1826. And the fact is that this consumer society, in combination with a technological society, has done a great deal to destroy American sense of community and community values. We are isolating ourselves more and more among the petty and paltry pleasures with which we glut our lives. And the data definitely shows that the amount of American volunteerism among adults has sharply decreased. Far fewer people are involved in activities to help the community than finding their way to the mall. This situation has become so severe and complicated by technology that I have a poem in the book about the increased isolation that our consumeritis and our technological society has led to. Do you think it would be appropriate to read that poem on the air?
Yeah, I was actually just going to segue into that because it's just amazing how with all this technology and all this capacity to further connect one another – there's so much aloneness.
There was an article in the September 14th, 1995 issue of the San Francisco Chronicle that was headlined, "Automation, Email, Encourage Isolation, A Less Social Society is Becoming Shy." And what the story said was that it summarized the findings of a university study about increasing social isolation, said that growing numbers of those people standing silently in line at the ATM and pumping their own self-service gas are probably victims of America's silent, anonymous epidemic. What they were talking about is the fact that if you're a shy person or a reclusive person, before these technological advances, if you had to go to the bank or go to the gas station, you had to deal with another human being. Mm-hmm. Technology has made that less and less necessary, so that it's perfectly possible now to go through life, even in a city, without any human contact. And that story inspired this poem, which I published in the book on the chapter on the social costs of consumeritis. And the poem is titled A Tale of Life in America, or John Alone. John Alone awoke to his radio clock long after the sun arose, but his blinds were closed and there was nothing else to wake him. John Alone showered and dressed and listened to the radio. He heard how hard the traffic was, and so John Alone took the subway car in silence. No one talked to him. John Alone waited at the ATM while others did their business, and then when John Alone arrived at his comfy cubicle, he read his ready email and listened to his messages, while upon his desk he heard the whirring of his fax. And then John Alone listened to the recorded message option menu so thoughtfully provided by his correspondent, and when he went to pay his overdue computer-generated bill, John Alone's answering machine spoke clearly to the callers who did not know the number of his beeper. And after John had left his messages in return, he turned to do his business, processing words as well as he could. His silent day's work done, John Alone returned to his subway seat and rode back home in silence. John Alone found it hard to choose whether he should watch TV tonight or play computer bridge. So he chewed upon the thought and dined upon his microwave, a special cordon bleu of filet in shallot gravy, and fell asleep to dream of flesh and blood and maybe. Then John Alone awoke to his radio clock long after the sun arose, but his eyes were closed and there was nothing else to wake him. I think that the point of that poem, I think, will be clear to most listeners, that it's become increasingly possible for us to live an isolated life in which we are really not fulfilling what it means to be a human being. Aristotle said who would live alone is either a beast or a god, that human beings are by nature social animals. The individualism, the self-seeking, narrow self-seeking individualism that consumeritis plays upon, coupled with the technology that allows us to cut off human relations, is making us a very unhappy people. But I am optimistic that that individualism can help to reawaken people to the extent that they become aware of their frustrations and unhappiness and send them in a new direction and give themselves energy to go in a new direction. That's the hope of this book. One of the other things that in terms of the damaging consequences of consumeritis, which we talk about, is its effect on both our domestic political situation and our international relations. Commercial advertising has been so successful that our political figures have learned from it, so that what we get in political advertising and even political statements by incumbent presidents and governors is no longer reasonable, informative political discourse, but ad bite politics, virtually depriving us of real political discourse in this country. There's a whole chapter on that. The film that's referred to is Citizen Kane, where Kane says, someone asks him what people will think about something, and he says, people will think what I tell them to think. Mm. He knows the power of the media, and he knows the power of the media to manipulate our thinking. Well, we've become so accustomed to ad-bite advertising and so reduced in our own attention span that we have come to accept the portrait of ourselves that politicians imply by not condescending to engage in real political discourse. The recent elections are a wonderful reason for some optimism and hope in the intelligence of the American electorate after seeing damage over a sustained period. But on the whole, commercial advertising has corrupted political process. And finally, in the last chapter before the remedies chapter, we talk about how consumeritis and American materialism and commercialism has really hurt us in terms of foreign relations, has lessened the goodwill of other nations toward this country, really, particularly, by the way, among the nations of Islam, how our standing among the other countries of the world has greatly declined as our increased materialism and commercialism has risen.
I just wanted to read this piece out of that chapter, Consumeritis and International Insecurity. You say here that in sum, much of the world now perceives Americans as gluttonous over-consumers who indulge themselves in more materialistic pursuits than is good for them, and at great expense to most of the rest of the world, while refusing to join the global community in its efforts to reduce environmental injuries and ecological dangers for which American consumeritis bears a disproportionately large responsibility. That's got to be difficult for America to swallow, to have to honestly, I mean, we have no choice at this point in our time, nearing the end of the year 2006, to stop and take in what we collectively have allowed to co-create over the last 50 years, 100 years, whatever, with respect to America's role on the planet and our role in consuming a third of the resources, yet only reflecting 5% of the population.
I have to say, by the way, that I think that there is a growing awareness mm-hmm. in this country of exactly this problem, of the excesses that we've gone to and the damage that it's doing. This book, I don't think I'm certainly not alone, a single voice crying in the wilderness about this problem. There are others. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Rifkin's book, The European Dream, opens or at the beginning talks about the perils of American consumption and how American culture is lagging behind European culture in an understanding of what really makes a community and a people and individuals happy. I think more there is a simplicity movement, a movement actually such as your own with the health, the six health vectors that you are very interested in promoting, Martin. So there are more and more people, I think, are aware of the fact that global warming is a problem, mm-hmm. part of which is caused by our excess reliance on fossil fuels, that there's an increasing need to get away from fossil fuels. I noticed the PG&E's ads now say renewable energy is the future. So our consciousness of our excesses is growing, and there's always room for hope there. But we still are in the midst, I think, of these addictions, and it will take a growing consciousness to combat what I call this tidal wave of commercialism with which we're always surrounded can only be combated one by one as there's a growing awareness mm-hmm. among the listeners of your program and the American public generally. Because no one is going to spend the money that the American advertising industry does to promote healthy ways of living that's right. not for somebody's profit, but except for the profit of the person who wants to pursue a true path of happiness.
Exactly. One person at a time. The book clearly points out that if something cannot go on forever, it will stop.
Yes, right.
It will stop. There's a stat in there about 60% of Americans say that their children are very materialistic. We've got about 10 minutes left. Maybe we can speak to some regard to the parents that get it, the parents that are aware of this, that see the materialism brewing in their children.
You know, there are two points that you just made that are relevant. First of all, I have found that a number of people who have bought the book have been older people who want to give it to their children or their grandchildren because they share – I mean, I'm in my mid-60s. They share – an understanding of the fact that our society was not so overwhelmed by commercialism and materialism of 30 or 40 years ago. And they want their children to become aware of it by seeing that things were not always this way. I know I have an associate in my office, Mark Harley, who is in his early 20s. And it occurred to me as I've talked to Mark about this book and what the project is, that since it, this great increase in the volume of commercialism can be identified – and consumer spending and excessive consumer spending can be identified to have started no later than the middle 80s. He's never known a time when our society was anything else other than this dominating culture of buying and selling and materialism. So I think that it is true that most people of Mark's generation and even a little older are just so accustomed to living in this culture of buying and selling that they may be less aware than older people are of the fact that they do have a choice to get away from it. Mark himself, I think, is aware of that. But I think that a lot of people of that age aren't aware that they do not need to find their sense of direction only to the mall.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your what are some of the larger objectives with respect to the book? There's other projects associated with this. I mean, this really is the wake-up call to American society with regards to our behavior.
I could quote a review of the book, which I might – that's on the back. The objective the modest objective of the book is the hope that some of its readers – will recognize in themselves how they may have been diverted from a deeper fulfillment of their own lives from causes of which they're less aware than they might be. So that the hope is that one by one, readers will enrich their own lives by making choices toward non-material and spiritual pursuits that will aid them to get on better paths of the pursuit of happiness. There are – the book does make certain institutional recommendations concerning advertising and tax policy and a number of those things. But essentially the book aims to help to increase the consciousness of Americans of at least ordinary intelligence to the greater breadth of choices they have to help recover for American society a greater reliance on its higher aspirations and on our and what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature, rather than continuing to be victimized and manipulated by commercialism in America. Whether this book will have any degree of success, of course, I think if even one person reads it and it helps that person live a healthier life, a more fulfilling life, it will not have been completely wasted. But whether this book can have a broader public effect and be, as one reviewer put it, a national tipping point, is going to depend, I think, mostly on word of mouth. And I hope you will tell listeners where they could buy this book.
Well, let's just jump into that right now before we wrap up. For those listening on the internet or anywhere else outside of the immediate San Francisco area, you can go to the website of the publisher, which is aandapress.com. That's aandapress.com. And you can purchase the book, I believe, through the website. And if you're here or in and around San Francisco, head over to the Haight, and you can pick up a copy of the book at the Booksmith and also at Into Video Video Store, both of which are on Haight Street. You can pick up copies of it there, and I implore you to do so. And the seeds of all change for us humans tend to come from either moving towards something or moving away from something, moving towards our own personal definition of what is happiness and fulfillment for ourselves, or moving away from those things that are causing us pain. And here the book clearly defines for us and lays out and helps us to see in our everyday lives those areas where our choices and our decisions are being conditioned and manipulated, and it's causing us pain, not personally, but also – not just personally, but societally, to our economy, to the planet, really to all structures within our complete environment in which we live. So even in that arena, we can use that, I think, specifically with the advertising example, to help maybe get us a bit angry to interrupt the pattern of the advertising, to look at the message for what it is, and then feel a bit insulted by what they're trying to communicate to us.
Yeah, one of the reviewers of the book that's quoted on the dust jacket says, "Too much for our own good is a secular sermon against materialism and in favor of the higher values of love, friendship, community, and active citizenship. It breathes the humane and scientific spirit of the Enlightenment, and in spite of its temperate language, exhibits an underlying anger and frustration with the direction in which American society has been moving. Lucid, learned, and elegantly written testimony to the resilience of humane and optimistic ideals in American life." And what I want to say about that's relevant to that quote to what you were just been talking about, Martin, is that each chapter of the book begins with a movie scenario, because we all love good movies. Mm. And the movie scenario is given as a metaphor for, and sometimes directly pointing to, the substantive subject of the chapter. One of the other reasons that I've used good movies is that American movies really are, American movies are the most popular movies in the world. American movies are watched, actually, in the United Kingdom, for example, 90% of the money that's spent on movies in the United Kingdom is spent on American movies. Mm. American movies gave the world an idea of what American culture was like, and really led people not only to envy us for the opulence that many American movies show, but because American movies concentrated usually on the happy ending and a kind of American idealism about the good life, it really led most of the world to love what America stood for. Unfortunately, what's happened in recent years is that our export of consumeritis is a large part of the reason that international opinion of America and Americans is in decline. Quite apart from, obviously, what's happened in Iraq and in our international relations, our image abroad is the image of, as the passage you read, of a materialist, materially addicted commercial people who have lost their human values, who live to work instead of work to live. And too much for our own good is an effort to say, let us recall what the highest and most admirable qualities we have as Americans in our pursuit of happiness at a higher level of our human being, to help restore even our domestic security in our international relations.
Thank you so much for being on the show today, Harrison.
Thank you.
I do believe that we are reaching some sort of a tipping point. I think we've seen that last week. And it's now time for each and every one of us, one person at a time, to begin to take action in our own way, to wake up and reconnect with those things that are really important to us inside, to ask ourselves those questions. So I implore you to pick up the book, Too Much for Our Own Good, The Consumeritis Epidemic, aandapress.com. If you want to connect with Harrison directly, you can do so at hjslaw@jps.net. He's here in San Francisco. Harrison Shepard, thanks for being on.
Thank you very much, Mark.
We'll be back next week with another episode of Reality Sandwich. You can hear this show at realitysandwichradio.com, and you can connect with me at healthfulliving.org. We'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Reality Sandwich on 89.5 KPOO, San Francisco. This show and any past shows of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com, where you can also read about upcoming shows. To learn more about Julie Matthews or Martin Matthews, go to healthfulliving.org. Thanks for listening.